Good morning, my name is Keegan Rasko, and I'd like to welcome you to Life Downstream. Life Downstream is a radio show where I, a high school student, and my high school English teacher, Mr. Andrew Morgan, talk to interesting people from around the area about their life experiences and how those experiences allowed them to learn outside of a classroom. And with that, I'll pass it over to Mr. Morgan to introduce our guest for today.
We're here today with John Goodenberger, public historian. John, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
So before the show, we talked a little bit about some of the different kind of roles you've played over the years. And I guess a good starting point would be to start with when you came to Astoria in the 70s. Can you tell us a little bit about what it was like when you first arrived and you were kind of bouncing between a couple different positions, right, when you first arrived here in the 70s?
Well, when I first arrived here in the 70s, I was still in elementary school, but we came here, and I was introduced through my fourth grade teacher to architecture.
Okay.
Because her husband was an architect, and he came and taught us how to draw, and I started to look around. The next step was that I was hired by Vera Galt, local historian and English teacher, to be her houseboy. And while I was there, she would tell me stories of history of the town. And I'd work in her historic house that she and her son, Bruce Burney, the city librarian, they had restored this house. So I was exposed in that way. So when I came back after college and after looking for work elsewhere, I had to kind of figure out what to do.
Okay.
And part of that was using my education, which was through architecture and through historic preservation. I had worked for a while as a carpenter up and down the Willamette Valley, working with tools of the 1850s, doing farmhouses in the Willamette Valley. But when I came back, that really wasn't an option to be a contractor in that way. So I started to, one, do small projects of preservation. But then the next thing that happened was unexpected, and that was that my former cross-country and track coach, Carl Dominey, saw me on the street, knew I needed some money, and said, I have an opening for coaching. Would you be interested? And I thought, for a lark, I'd do it. And I actually started off not as a distance runner, which is what I am, but I was the sprints, jump, and pole vault coach.
Okay.
And took that on. But Carl was so good about teaching me every aspect there. And eventually, after about the third year, I became the distance coach under him. But I was the distance coach, and I worked with him in cross country as well.
Okay. Let's talk a little bit about your coaching. So how many total years did you end up coaching?
I think 21 or 22 seasons.
Okay.
Yeah.
And most of that, like you said, was distance.
Focus. Yes, it was mostly distance runners. Yeah.
Do you feel like that experience over the years, you perfected, you know, some aspects of your coaching and learned some things about just what is the best way to coach someone to run faster, run longer?
Well, the first is the encouragement part, which is that everybody is on the team, and we are a team. We are like a family, and whether you're fast or slow, you're still a part of that team and that family, and you can contribute. The slowest person can be the most inspirational person.
Hmm.
So there's that aspect. And then the other aspect is setting goals and breaking things into sections, breaking those goals into sections, and also breaking the races into sections. So 3-mile race, first mile, anybody can run it. It's no problem. Middle mile, that's when people start to slow down. You really have to start thinking about why in the world you're out there.
Yeah.
And that's all you think about is that middle section. Because when you get to the third section, anybody can run that and sprint for the end in front of everybody.
Hmm.
So it's breaking things down into smaller pieces with the mindset of, I have a reason to be here and I have a goal to be here as well.
So I like to run in my free time, and I've never really gotten I didn't do cross country in high school, and I actually just recently ran my first race, a trail run. And I think running, maybe more than other sports, is so mental and psychological. And I wonder if, you know, you found over the years that like half of coaching cross country is teaching kids how to think while they run. Do you feel like that's accurate?
Yes. And so Carl would always say it's at least 80% in the head. And one of the things that attracted me as a student of his, I went out for cross country as a junior, was that he handed me a book. And he accepted that I had a mind and that I could learn, and handed me a book to figure it out. And this was all about self-perception. So, yeah, it's totally mental.
I'm curious because you actually coached my sister, who was actually a former guest on this show. Is there anything that you remember about her? I'd like to see if you could embarrass her.
She was a perfect student in every way.
Oh, well, that's not what I was looking for.
So you coached for over 20 years, and then while you were coaching, you continued to pursue your interest in architecture and preservation. Can you talk a little bit about what is it about historic architecture that is so fascinating for you, and why is that such a compelling subject for you?
There's at least two parts. One is the design, and the other is the history. So the design, the proportions, the materials that are used as well, and the details of the building. And then the second part of that is the history, the social history. I was taken under the wings of Philip Dole when I was in college, and at that point he was the grandfather of preservation in Oregon. And he knew every detail on every historic farm building in the Willamette Valley. But he also was a lover of that social history and had a wonderful morbid sense of humor as well. And so that was one of the ways that he taught us. And one of the ways I teach my students is, here's the details. Now I'm going to hope that you can hold on to those details by remembering the social history that goes with it, and tell those stories that go with it. So both those are really important to me.
And do you feel, so it almost sounds like the social history is this, like, this tool, this vehicle that you can use to make some of these other facts stick. Would you say that's kind of how you see it? Some of the backstory is helpful for that?
And I also go back to, like, back in the 1960s when the city of Astoria had a demolition program. And the demolition program, we wiped out many, 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 many buildings. And there was somebody, Dr. Harvey, who ran around and put plaques on buildings. And those plaques told the history of the house. And he figured if they knew the history of this house, they'd be less likely to knock it down. And so I think that social history is really important for people just to stop and realize it's more than just a simple house. It has all of this length of history going with it.
Is that where you see all of the centennial signs come from on houses now? Did it spur out of that program?
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Interesting.
I know right now you are kind of working as an archivist for the library.
Right.
And you're trying to tackle this huge project. Is that the best way to describe this? About the Flavelles. You're writing a book about the local family, the Flavelles. And I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about kind of what this project is requiring you to do in terms of logistics and organization. How are you going about writing about this famous family?
So first, when I get depressed, I have to remember what I taught my students, which is break it into sections and understand that the project has different phases.
It's like a race, right?
It's very exactly like this. A race. So, you know, I've been at it for a little over a year. And for the sake of argument of dividing things up, I'm through the first mile. Okay. And now I'm in the section where everybody gets depressed and tired and wonders what in the world they're doing out there and all. Because you really have to settle into the project. So there's acknowledging of that, but also with the project itself, I'm walking into a room which is a former jail. It's in the basement of the Heritage Museum, and I work in this room, and it's filled with boxes and tubs of letters. And so I have hundreds, if not thousands, of letters to sort through. And those letters have gone through a preliminary sort. One of my former students was an internist there. Brooke Willoughby was an internist there, and she did a preliminary sort of, these are all the letters going to Mary Louise or Florence or whomever. And so we have that kind of sort. And then I'm going through those bins and pulling out letters and reading them and trying to make a story from those letters. As I pull them out, I don't necessarily know where I am in the story or what I need to pay attention to. So what I do is I just basically grab a bunch of letters and read them and see if I can think of a theme or see a theme. Stop, go back, start a spreadsheet. So I have a spreadsheet going for all those letters. One column is dates, the other column is from, then to, and then a description. Sometimes quotes, otherwise other times just a description of what's in that letter. What that allows me to do is, one, see everything chronologically, but two, on a spreadsheet, I can click it so that all of the letters from Harry Melville Flavel can be in one section, and I can see what he's writing and saying to people, or do it in the same way for those receiving the letters, and start to think of themes there. It's a back and forth process of going into those bins and pulling letters out and putting them on the spreadsheets, and then also at the same time, as I can, putting those letters in chronological order.
I think what's so interesting for me about this whole process is you're doing this with a faith and a belief that a theme will emerge, and you just, I think that so many people would find this so daunting. You know, you're looking at all of this source material and there is no initial obvious structure there, but you're just flipping through these letters waiting for a structure to be visible to you.
Right. So it's not, I've been asked, well, where's your outline? And it's not like doing research in college where you can essentially get an outline because you know that there are known sources with this information and you're going to go to these sources, these books, and pull that information. I don't know that. I don't know where this is going to go. I mean, I know from the family history some general things, but what turn it might take, I don't know.
I imagine there must be a small part of you that hopes that you will discover something in one of these letters that has previously been unreported, and some, I don't know, is there a chance that this might happen? Are you, in the back of your mind, is that something you're really hoping will happen?
Oh, yeah. I've learned I'm wrong.
Tell us about that.
No, I can't. You have to read the book. But minor things that find out, oh, that's why that happened, and I misinterpreted, or somebody else misinterpreted that.
Yeah.
So that's something. But one of the chapters that I've written is about Florence, and Florence is the mother of Harry and Mary Louise of the last generation, and she was married to Harry Melville. And so I've written a whole chapter on her background, which people don't know about.
Yeah.
And that was actually a chapter that turned out that there was an arc.
Okay.
And it was between wars, from World War I to World War II, and her family serving in both of those wars and what it was like. And one of the themes, I will say, that I have found is just a hand's length from the money. Your life is like everybody else's, and there's frankly a lot of suffering. Suffering financially, because I'm talking about the depression and all. And, you know, so Florence's brother is suffering financially. Florence's father is suffering financially, and they're that close, you know, and they're relying on the Flavels. If they could just get some money from the Flavels, everything will be okay.
Wow. I'm curious, you know, we chatted before the show about you have this personal connection to the Flavels.
Right.
And I'm wondering, you know, how do you navigate these different kind of roles and responsibilities of somebody who knows the Flavels and wants to honor their memory, their reputation, and then somebody who wants to report on exactly how things happened, good, bad, and everything in between. Can you talk a little bit about that, how you kind of walk that fine line?
So at this point, what I'm trying to do is just get everything down and not make necessarily that judgment. And so that will be at the end. I'm just kind of imagining all these sheets of paper spread all over the floor and us looking at it and saying, this really doesn't play a role in this story. It may be interesting, but it doesn't play a role in this story. Let's drop that. Or as uncomfortable as this piece is, this is really significant. This really explains things. And in the end, it also humanizes that story. Having said that, I will say that the Flavelles are very honest in their letters about what's going on in their lives. Hmm. And I have read some very uncomfortable letters. Do we have all of the letters that have ever been written? No. Hmm. But what we have is really good. And so we can't ever make this statement that, well, so-and-so never wrote about this. We don't know that. That may have been over in the corner and was never grabbed.
Hmm. I'm sitting here thinking how different of a time we live in today. We live in a letterless time for the most part now. People aren't writing letters the way they used to.
No.
And, I'm curious, you know, what you think about, well, first of all, when you're reading these letters, are you noticing trends across all of these different letters? You know, do a lot of them start in the same way and finish in the same way? And what type of content are people talking about in letters? Because I'm imagining, like, if a high school student were to listen to this show and we're talking about all these letters, I wonder if students are thinking, like, what were they writing? Why were they writing all these letters?
You know, like,
it's just such a different era. So what have you learned reading all these letters?
One of the things that I find fascinating that really gets you in the era is the last kind of sentences. Oh, I hear the train whistle. I need to get the letter down to the dock.
That's great. That's
awesome. Because they have to get it on that train as it leaves.
Wow.
You know, and so I find that fascinating. And I can see, and this, in some cases, they'll write several letters to the same person in one day.
Wow.
So it's
Why would they do something like that?
Well, yeah. We tweet all the time. Well, yeah. I don't have any of that capability, but others do.
Yeah.
You know, and so they just have something, maybe they've just received a letter and they need to respond to that quickly.
Hmm.
So the letters, you know, generally start off with kind of the mundane, the weather, the this, the that. And then, of course, there's the response to the person who just wrote them. Mm. And then there's an elaboration of all of that.
Mm.
But, you know, their letters are writing about maybe the parties that they've gone to. It's maybe writing about one of their children having problems in school or something like that.
So would you say the tone of these is often, it feels like reportage. This happened. How much is introspection and, you know, the person revealing how they actually think and feel and their innermost thoughts? Are those more rare?
No, they're not. And so without going into a lot of it, there is a character who is very concerned about others in the family and writes some of the most caustic letters about what is wrong with these individuals. I mean, I'm thinking kind of like Bette Davis would be a lightweight. You know,
so this person is preoccupied with this
other people's lives and how they need to be improved and what's wrong with them and all of this. And it's like, oh my gosh.
Wow.
How can you write that to somebody that you are related to? In particular, how can you write that to somebody that you are related to? And it's very uncomfortable reading those kinds of letters.
Wow.
The other thing is we have telegrams.
Hmm.
And I have this whole chapter. So those of you who may have attended Talking Tombstones, I played Harry Melville, and I did the whole thing about the tragic death of his son. Well, we have all these telegrams going back and forth about, what are we going to do? Do we need to take him to the doctor now? Do we need to do this? Do we need to do that? Is there time? Can we wait? Can we? And all of this, since we have that kind of that tension through these telegrams going back and forth. And to me, that's really interesting to see that. And ultimately, it's tragic because they didn't move fast enough.
I'm curious. You talked about your spreadsheets to categorize letters by whom they're going to, whom they're sent by, and then the chronological order. But I'm curious as to whether or not you think that technology has had a mostly beneficial effect on history and the way we archive, or if by using technology we're actually biasing the way that we think about, you know, history and some of the archival data that we see.
Oh boy, is that a great question. And my shorter answer is I don't know. I think in the end it can help us, because I'm sure if others were more apt with spreadsheets than I am or had other technology, they could find things. So for instance, you know, a PDF, it's searchable. Okay, so it's not searchable yet with handwriting, but if I were to type up those letters, I could, and someone has typed up the diaries, I can search, and I'm not giving things away, but how many times there are men in that house with the women, all right? You know? And so it's searchable in that way, and that's really useful, which you could do by hand or you could do intuitively, but the answer is right there, and so that's super helpful.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering if by putting it into a PDF, if you're actually damaging the history as it was. Like, isn't there some value into keeping a letter as it was when you could look at a PDF that says the same thing? Doesn't it alter the way we think?
Oh, to me, yes, it does. I mean, I love the letter. I mean, I love the fact that some of them have graphics on it, like the hotel that they're staying in, these beautiful graphics. Then there's the handwriting, and then there's the texture. And I'm just learning things like that, just random things. I didn't know they had hot pink paper in the 1870s. You know, and in some cases, the paper, it looks as good as the day it was put in that envelope. Mm-hmm. You know, so seeing all that, that really brings out character to me. Mm-hmm. The other part of the PDF, somebody has to translate it.
Exactly. Yeah.
And, you know, maybe they don't get the translation correct. They so, for instance, I'm looking at a document that is about the captain getting his license to be a pilot on the river. And they're referring to a mill. What mill? The one person has translated as Parker's Mill. The Parkers didn't come for 2 years after that. Somebody else has Parking Mill. What in the world are they talking about? You know, and so that little bit gets it off. Mm-hmm. And so again, if also with people, the spelling is so important. So if I want to go after Mr. So-and-so, I need to really make sure, because sometimes I's and E's in real life get mixed.
Yeah.
I want to know who they're talking about. And so I want to go back to that original source. Thank you for the translation, but I want to go back to that original source. Mm-hmm. Technology is also useful, though, in that if I have a letter and I can barely read it because it's thin paper and you can see both sides of the writing, you know, coming through. And so I'll stand at the computer and I'll read it into the computer because I could never type that and because I keep losing my place.
Yeah.
So I can read it into the computer, I can get a rough draft, and then I can go back and clean it up.
Mm-hmm. John, I know you were one of the founders of the Historic Preservation Program at Clatsop Community. And this question, I think, ties into the way you look at historic buildings and you look at a story like that of the Flavelles. What's your kind of, if you have a personal philosophy about history and why some of these things are valuable, what would you say is the value in preserving every detail of the Flavelle story, in preserving all of these old houses? I know it's like an obvious kind of question. Like, I don't think any of these things should slip away into obscurity. But for you, what's the thing that is driving this urge to preserve all of these things, to keep all of this from disappearing?
So could we use the yin and the yang? So the it's both universal and local at the same time. Buildings and these stories have a universal appeal, but they're all very specifically local. And, you know, we talk about doing alterations to buildings. Well, they do this on the East Coast, but they don't here. And that's what makes it special to have this kind of material here, this kind of detail here. And so that makes Astoria, Astoria, not Miami, not Boston, not somewhere else. Yes, that's perfectly fine. But we have our own character here. In its whole diversity, we have a specific character here.
If I'm hearing you correctly, it's almost inspired by this belief that every place is unique. And if we don't do this, we run the risk of having it kind of start to look like every other place and lose some of that uniqueness.
Right.
To it.
And lose the ability to tell that human story, too.
John, we don't have too much time left. Is there something that folks can kind of look ahead to in the next month or two? What's on your radar that people should be kept abreast of? Is there anything going on with the historic preservation classes? Anything happening in your world?
Well, we're staying inside right now because of bad weather. But coming up in the spring, we're going to be working on the church in Deep River, for instance. So we'll be out working and certainly can stop by and see that. I think we're going to be out in the Flavel House yard working on a rock wall, a dry-laid rock wall. And, boy, I'm trying to remember what are some of our other ones. But, you know, first, I'd say stop by and see us. Second, I can say, like to say, anybody can take our classes. You do not need to be a contractor or have any kind of pre-experience. You can come and take our classes and take our workshops.
And if somebody's interested in finding out more information, I'm assuming online all these classes are detailed. You can see exactly what types of classes are in the program. Okay,
go to the college website.
John Gutenberger, thank you so much for
coming
and
welcome.
Talking to us.
Thanks.
So this is the portion of the show where I offer my student perspective on our in-studio guest today. And one of the things that I found most interesting about John's interview was the almost timeless nature in which he viewed the human experience. When we spoke immediately before the interview, he was talking about his life and, you know, the kinds of things that brought him back to Astoria. And it was interesting because as he talked about it, you realize that he was talking out of a chronological order. You know, he would go from his childhood to the 2008 market crash back to when he was in high school, and you see these kinds of flips around. And I think that that really speaks to the way that he observes the way other people live. As a historian and somebody who looks at these archives regularly, sometimes we aren't given information all at once, so it's interesting to see the order and the manner in which he categorizes this information, and I think that that reflects in the way that he interacts with people on a daily basis. And perhaps what our audience might find even more intriguing was the lengths to which John went to capture the favelas. He spends a lot of his time going through individual letters and sorting them based upon who they go to, who they came from, and what they're about, and then orders them chronologically so that he can completely understand the wider picture of the family. And that attention to detail is really important, because the challenge of capturing multiple generations of a single family is almost infinitely daunting. But John, in his approach, by sectioning things off, making things smaller, taking off small bits and pieces, makes that challenge seem less broad. And that same strategy we can apply to the kinds of things that we do, whether you're an artist, or whether you are a contractor, whether you are an office worker, whatever you do, it's a lot easier to break the big task into smaller ones and then do the small tasks. So I think the next time we're challenged, it would behoove us all, and this might seem like a no-brainer, but to break down those larger challenges into smaller bits and pieces. Sometimes that strategy seems so obvious that we don't actually give it the time and effort to actually work properly. So I think it's important that we keep ourselves honest and that we check ourselves along the road to make sure that we're staying on track. And I think John demonstrated that very well.